Greetings and pathetic corona-demic recriminations, my poltamictic listeners. Welcome to this March 2020 Science News Update. I'm your host for this suffocatingly isolated podcast, Jim Campanella. Shall we start off with COVID-19? Sure, why not? Everyone loves a good COVID-19 story. Listeners just can't get enough. They love the rancid taste of COVID-19. Ew. Well, we have all been affected by this horror show. Has science been affected? Oh, yeah. The biggest way that science has been affected by corona is by having a large number of conferences canceled. Want a list? Are you curious? Sure, why not? Let's see here. The Northeastern Meeting of the American Society of Plant Biology in Westbury, New York has been canceled. The National Postdoctoral Association meeting in March in San Diego was canceled. Also canceled for San Diego was the Experimental Biology meeting for April and the Future of Experimental Technology Conference for late March. The American Physical Society canceled its March meeting last week for Denver. The American Chemical Society canceled its meeting in Philadelphia for this month. The April meeting of the American Association for Cancer Research was postponed until next year. In my world, we call that being canceled, not postponed. Also, the Lunar and Planetary Science Conference in Woodlands, Texas was canceled for March. Oh, and I guess every conference in Italy, well, Europe and China were canceled. No surprise there, I guess. Is this being disruptive? I would say that COVID-19 is all kinds of disruptive. Heck, besides making us sick and threatening our lives, does it really need to inconvenience us as well? Well, all right. From bad to worse, let's try something new. Idiot colleges for the privileged of the month. The U.S. Department of Education is investigating Harvard and Yale universities for allegedly failing to disclose funds from other nations, according to a statement released on February 12th. This was first reported in the Wall Street Journal, and the investigations are the latest in a series of efforts by the Department of Education to crack down on foreign influence in U.S. institutions. U.S. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos, by the way, truly an intellectual among intellectuals, stated,
"This is about transparency. If colleges and universities are accepting foreign money and gifts, their students, donors, and taxpayers deserve to know how much and from whom. Unfortunately, the more we dig, the more we find that too many are underreporting or not reporting at all."
All of this follows on the heels of investigations into six other universities, including Cornell and MIT, in an effort that the Department of Education says has already led to the reporting of $6.5 million in previously undisclosed funding since the beginning of last July. In those cases, the money came from Qatar, China, Saudi Arabia, and several other countries. Concerning the new investigations, the Department of Ed says in the statement that, quote, "Yale University may have failed to report at least $375 million in foreign gifts and contracts, while Harvard may lack appropriate institutional controls over foreign money and has failed to report fully all foreign gifts and contracts as required by law," unquote. Well, we already know about Harvard. You may remember last month I reported on that winner, Dr. Charles Lieber, chair of Harvard's Chemistry and Biochemistry Department. Remember how he was recently arrested and charged with a criminal offense after he was accused of lying about his connections with and funding from the Chinese government? The Inside Higher Education Journal writes that Harvard and Yale say that they are preparing responses to the Department of Education's announcement. Can't wait for that. What exactly are they going to say? We forgot? Ah, well. Okay, after those two stories, I don't even know if you can call these stories, let's get completely away from Earth. This is just getting depressing. Here are three astro stories. I guess you could sort of call them astronomy stories. We can argue as to whether we could do that. First up, Iron Rain? Okay, that sounds like a rock band name, or maybe an album name at the very least, or maybe a long-lost song from Bruce Springsteen. Anyway, it is not. I'm talking about actual real Iron Rain, not metaphoric Iron Rain. A planet called WASP-76b is about 390 light years away from our solar system. It is a gas giant, similar to Jupiter, but with a much shorter orbit around its star, fewer than 2 Earth days. It always faces its star on the same side. It's in a locked orbit. And because it orbits so close, the day side is about 1,000 times hotter than the night side, reaching temperatures of about 2,400 degrees Celsius. That means that the side facing toward us is too dark to be seen by a telescope. But a small amount of starlight filters through the planet's atmosphere, revealing the outer edges. Until now, no one has gotten a close enough look at an ultra-hot gas giant to see how such stark temperature contrasts affect atmospheric chemistry across the planet. The team analyzed this light and detected a signal of gaseous iron, of all things, which is found in the atmospheres of other ultra-hot Jupiters. WASP-76b's iron signal, however, was unevenly distributed, present during the planet's evening transition from day to night, but not from night to day. Dr. David Ehrenreich's team from the University of Geneva reported in Nature earlier this month that they could discern this from the amount of light they saw on either side of WASP-76b, which correspond to the boundaries between day and night. Until now, no one has gotten a close enough look at an ultra-hot gas giant to see how such stark temperature contrasts affect atmospheric chemistry across the planet. Ehrenreich's team used the Very Large Telescope in Chile to examine starlight filtering through WASP-76b's atmosphere as the exoplanet passed in front of its sun during 2 orbits in 2018. Those observations revealed the chemical components of different regions of the atmosphere. Because the evening transition results in a drastic temperature drop, the team thinks the iron condenses into clouds when it reaches the darker, colder side of the planet, which means that it actually rains liquid iron droplets during WASP-76b's nighttime. Can you imagine clouds of iron vapor? I'm not even sure what that could possibly mean. Ehrenreich says that, quote, "It seems likely that iron rain is present on WASP-76b, but it is unclear whether other ultra-hot Jupiters have the same weather. That will depend on the wind speed and temperature difference between the day and the night side," unquote. Here's another short story from our wonderful cosmos. Earth might have a new moon. All right, it's a tiny one, but it's new. Then you could call it a moon, sort of. On February 19th, astronomers at the Catalina Sky Survey in Arizona spotted a dim object moving quickly across the sky. After the next few days, researchers at 6 more observatories around the world watched the object, designated 2020 CD3, and calculated its orbit, confirming that it has been gravitationally bound to Earth for about 3 years. An announcement posted by the Minor Planet Center, which monitors small bodies in space, states that, quote, "no link to a known artificial object has been found," implying that it is most likely an asteroid caught by Earth's gravity as it passed by. This is just the second asteroid known to have been captured by our planet as a mini-moon. The first, 2006 RH120, hung around between September 2006 and June 2007 before escaping. Our new moon is probably between 2 and 3.5 meters across, or roughly the size of a car, making it no match for Earth's primary moon. It circles our planet about once every 47 days on a wide oval-shaped orbit that mostly swoops far outside our larger moon's orbit. Dr. Grigory Federitz of Queen University, one of the study members, said, quote, "The object isn't stable, so eventually 2020 CD3 will be flung away from Earth. It is heading away from the Earth-Moon system even as we speak, and it looks likely it will escape in April," unquote. Though Federitz states this, apparently there are several different simulations of its trajectory, and they don't all agree. There will have to be more observations to accurately predict the fate of our mini-moon. and even to confirm that it is definitely a temporary moon and not just a piece of artificial space debris. Federer says, however, quote, that our international team is continuously working to constrain a better solution. Next story. Dr. Julie McJock of Harvard University has suggested in an article posted to archive.org that she and her research group have isolated a space protein from a meteorite. Huh? Space protein? McJock's team claims to have found a protein inside of a meteorite. It would be the first protein ever discovered from beyond Earth. First, this is not an indication of alien life because it's possible to generate proteins just from chemical reactions. However, this is quite controversial because many scientists are skeptical whether the analysis really has found anything at all. We know that amino acids, which are organic compounds that act as the building blocks of proteins in life, can form on meteors and other space rocks. But the extent of prebiotic chemistry beyond Earth is still unknown, and how that chemistry turns into life is, well, even more mysterious. The problem is that once stuff gets to Earth, you can't just go looking for organic compounds there. You can't say, oh, hey, look at this protein. Because just by being on Earth in a place filled with life, it's going to get contaminated. How do you tell a contaminant from something that came from outer space? You see the problem here? McJock says that she and her colleagues are able to get around the contamination issues, and what they found is real. They analyzed a pristine sample of a meteorite that was found in Algeria in 1990. First, they used a series of small, carefully sanitized drills, similar to dentistry ones, to collect material from deep inside the meteorite. They prepared the resulting powder by mixing it with liquids, including water and chloroform. And finally, they fired a laser at the samples to turn them into gas. Gas can then be analyzed in a process called mass spectrometry, and that will tell you whether you have proteins or not. When they examined the gases, the researchers found a combination of amino acids and additional atoms, which they say is evidence for the first extraterrestrial protein. If this passes a technical review and is really true, and the jury is still out on this, then it's an important result because it suggests that certain types of chemical reactions could have occurred on the surface of the Earth or other planets and led to or helped the emergence of life. Maybe. If this mystical chemistry could occur on a barren rock in the vacuum of space, that means it's easier to make the building blocks of life in more extreme environments than we actually thought. Next story is mainly for my wife, who believes that I'm going deaf. I suspect most wives believe that their husbands are going deaf, but I suspect also that it is rarely an organic issue. Hearing loss affects around 48 million Americans, with many reporting the first symptom as the loss and inability to follow a single speaker in a noisy environment. Despite this, conventional hearing tests struggle to detect hearing loss at the conversational level, meaning that many sufferers go undiagnosed. Now, in a study published recently in eLife, a team led by Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary researcher Dr. Daniel Polly has identified two biomarkers that may explain why an individual with normal hearing could struggle to follow conversations in loud environments. These biomarkers could pave the way toward clinical testing for hidden hearing loss, which currently cannot be measured using standard hearing exams. Polly says, quote, between the increased use of personal listening devices or the simple fact that the world is a much noisier place than it used to be, patients are reporting as early as middle age that they are struggling to follow conversations in the workplace and social settings, where other people are also speaking in the background. Current clinical testing cannot pick up what's going wrong with this very common problem, unquote. Polly first examined over 100,000 patient records from the Massachusetts Eye and Ear Infirmary's audiology database. He discovered that around 10% of the patients who presented with complaints about hearing difficulties were found to be in good health, according to the auditory tests. Since common hearing tests are not designed to detect problems related to understanding speech in real-world environments, the researchers developed two sets of tests that would reflect the issues of diagnosing hidden hearing loss. The researchers then recruited 23 young or middle-aged participants with clinically normal hearing to undergo the tests. One such test involved recording how intensely the participant needed to focus on a conversation in a noisy environment by measuring changes in the pupil diameter with specialized glasses. The other test measured EEG signals from the surface of the ear canal to determine the participant's ability to detect subtle changes in frequency. Pauly discovered, as expected, that despite all participants having clinically healthy hearing, their ability to follow conversations with other distracting voices varied considerably. The tests the author developed allowed them to identify participants who likely struggle with hidden hearing loss. These results suggest that incorporating these biomarkers into clinical hearing tests could be successful in diagnosing hidden hearing disorders. The identified biological and behavioral markers would be relatively easy to incorporate into clinical tests and could help health providers to understand, treat, and monitor these hearing difficulties. Pauly closes with, quote, "Speech is one of the most complex sounds that we need to make sense of. If our ability to converse in social settings is part of our hearing health, then the tests that are used have to go beyond the very first stages of hearing and more directly measure auditory processing in the brain," unquote. Next story. Scientists have created new superconducting compounds of hydrogen and praseodymium, a rare earth metal. One substance being quite a surprise from the perspective of classical chemistry. The study helped find the optimal metals for room temperature superconductors. The results were published in Science Advances by a research group led by Dr. Dmitry Semenok of the company Skoltech. A theory has evolved in the past 15 years that assumes that hydrogen compounds, hydrides, can make excellent superconductors, that is, substances that have zero electrical resistance when cooled down to a certain temperature and are capable of carrying electricity without any losses, which would obviously be particularly valuable for power networks. However, the sticking point that scientists are still striving to work out is the temperature at which a substance becomes superconducting. For most compounds, it's low, very low. So superconductors used in real life are typically cooled with liquid helium using complex and costly equipment that you couldn't use in a neighborhood or out in the burbs or anywhere else. Physicists are busy searching for a substance that becomes superconducting at room temperature. One of the likely candidates is metallic hydrogen, but the pressures required to actually produce metallic hydrogen are insane. They exceed 4 million atmospheres. Semenok's Russian team created compounds of hydrogen and praseodymium, a metal from the lanthanide series on the periodic table, and they study their physical properties. The authors synthesized several compounds with different ratios of atoms of each element. And to do that, they placed praseodymium and hydrogen samples in a special chamber where they pressed between two cone-shaped diamonds so that the pressure was increased to a huge amount, and then they were laser heated. The elements got compressed and reacted to form the compound praseodymium hydride. The scientists then replaced pure hydrogen with ammonium borane, a compound that has a large amount of hydrogen readily released when heated and reacts with praseodymium. And they found that this method was more effective, and they continue to use that for further experiments. By increasing the pressure, they obtained praseodymium H9. The molecules they obtained fall into a special category in classical chemistry called the outlaw group, since they don't seem to obey the usual rules of chemistry. Anyway, Semenok investigated superconductivity of the new substances by measuring electrical resistance at different temperatures and pressures and found that the praseodymium hydride becomes superconducting at minus 264 degrees Celsius, which is lower than the lanthanum hydride, and although the two compounds are both chemically and structurally similar. Seminoc says, quote, "We applied the method used previously to synthesize lanthanum hydrides and succeeded in creating new superconducting metallic praseodymium hydrides. We came to two main conclusions. First, you could get abnormal compounds with compositions having nothing to do with valence, that is, the number of bonds that an atom can usually make. Second, we validated the new principle for creating superconductors. We found that the metals from the lability zone, located between groups 2 and 3 of the periodic table, are the best candidates. And these elements are lanthanum and cerium. Going forward, we will proceed from this finding to obtain new high-temperature superconductors." Unquote. Last story of the evening. Okay, I had intended to stay away from talking about COVID-19 very much, but there are just too many worried people out there for me now to not talk about this study. It just came in a couple of days ago, and it's a very hopeful one for those of you out there who think that we are in apocalyptic times. Exactly how deadly is COVID-19? Well, that's been a real question up till now, and I think this is what makes everyone think of the 12 monkeys scenario. Don't. It's not that bad. Limited testing and undetected cases make it hard to pin down how many are infected, right? And that number is crucial for calculating the ratio of people who may actually die from COVID-19. Ta-da! Enter the Diamond Princess cruise ship. Remember, they were quarantined off Japan after a passenger tested positive for COVID-19, well, for the SARS. And the ship became a natural data lab where nearly everyone was tested and, well, very few cases of infection could be missed. Dr. Timothy Russell, an epidemiologist at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, reported March 9th in a paper posted to medrxiv.org that infections and deaths on board the ship suggest that the disease's true fatality ratio in China is probably only about 0.5%, though that number may vary from place to place. That 0.5% is way less than the 3.4% of confirmed cases that the World Health Organization has come up with. I mean, mind you, 0.5% is troubling, but it's way, way less. The World Health Organization's number has come under fire because the true number of people infected with the virus worldwide is still, I suspect, even when you guys hear this at the end of the month, is still probably unknown. Russell says, quote, "How worried should we be? Well, it's more severe than the flu, which annually kills hundreds of thousands worldwide and has an estimated 0.1% fatality rate. But it's not as bad as some numbers have suggested." Unquote. As of February 20th, tests of most of the 3,711 people aboard the Diamond Princess confirmed that 634, or 17% of them, had the virus. 328 of them did not have any symptoms at the time of diagnosis. Of those with symptoms, the fatality ratio was 1.9%. Russell and colleagues calculate, of all affected, that ratio was 0.91%. Those 70 or older were most vulnerable, with an overall fatality ratio of about 7.3%. So if we extrapolate with those numbers to China, the team estimates that 1.1% of symptomatic cases are turning deadly there. The asymptomatic cases drops that ratio to about 0.5% in China, the team calculates. Russell cautions, quote, "These ratios depend on available healthcare and public health measures, and there are still uncertainties in the data. For example, some patients initially counted as asymptomatic may later develop symptoms or even die, so the true fatality rate may be somewhat higher, maybe 0.6% or 0.7%, but that's still a good ratio," unquote. And I cannot argue with Dr. Russell. Anything that brings us below 1% mortality rate for the first global pandemic in 100 years is good enough for me. I don't know if this puts my mind at ease, but I think it certainly helps, my gentle listeners. That's all for me for now. Keep washing those hands. Watch out for iron rain. Keep watching the skies. And I hope I've inspired some of you. Stay healthy until next time. This is Jim Campanella.